we welcome in writer Colin Fleming. His latest book is entitled Meatheads Say the Realest Things. It is available everywhere. And Colin is here to talk with us. Hello, sir.
Hey, what's up, Kimbo? It's too darn hot.
It is too darn hot. And look, I know it, but, you know, I'm a weak little man. But when I see you impacted by the heat, well, I know we're talking serious heat.
Oh, dear. I've given off the weakness vibe. That's not what I'm going for, but yes, it's worn me down. I mean, I walked 5 miles today. I ran a mile and a half. And yesterday I ran 3 very plodding miles. But on Sunday when I did the stairs at BC, I had to take a couple breaks to do it only 10 times. So it wasn't good. But you know what I learned today, courtesy of Facebook, which I'm not really on anymore? Today is my anniversary for when I started climbing the monument, which I can no longer climb because it still remains closed. So need to get that bad boy back open again.
How many years ago did you start doing that?
It wasn't that long ago, actually. I was sort of wondering when it was. It was 2017. And the Facebook post I put up, which, of course, no one had any interest in whatsoever because it's me, was like, oh, I went up the monument and I did something I've never done before. I tried to see if you could do it twice. It's like my humble beginning as a monument climber. So I need that to open because it is a pain in my royal Boston ass to have to walk all the way out to Chestnut Hill. Kimball, you'd be surprised. When you're driving around next time, note how hard it is to find like a giant staircase. You need really at least 100 stairs to do it justice. Otherwise, you're just like a guy kind of going up a ramp and coming back down, and you don't get anything out of it. But I have to go like 10 miles away to get 100-plus stairs. It's not a good time.
No, I understand that completely. I wanted to ask you about this because I saw your post on social media. Why in the world did Bruce Cassidy get fined $25,000?
Oh, I think that's just if you say anything, if you kind of do what hockey coaches call a love tap, like coaches lie, just a love tap, and the things that people used to say, coaches used to say, that I can't even repeat in there, but they were great things. But if you do the verbal version of that, I think it's like arguing balls and strikes. I think it's kind of like a zero policy. But by the same token, like I posted, why should, if that's the equivalent of a love tap, then why shouldn't you be able to be fined for the analog of a flop? Because Trotz has worked these officials exceedingly well, I feel like. He's in their heads, and it might not be a conscious decision, and the Bruins have certainly their other problems that they're in this position in the first place, but the refs aren't doing them any favors. And I think Cassidy, the Bruins themselves, will absorb that fine because it's worth it. All of a sudden, Bergeron's getting chased off the faceoff dot now. It's like, gee, I wonder why that's happening. Like, you have to say something. I mean, the ship is sinking here.
Now, last night, obviously not a good game for Tuukka Rask, but I think he still gets the start in Game 6, right?
Oh, no. I think there's no way. I think you might as well just capitulate the season. Look, it's not up on the blog yet. I was writing it before you called. But there is no way an NHL goalie, there is no set of circumstances in which it's permissible to allow 4 goals on 16 shots. If you have 16 penalty shots, you can't give up 4 goals. So what happens with Rask is if he's not 100% right, physically, mentally, he's a season killer. He gets the regular season stats. He's a great goalie. So technically sound. But if something is a little off with this guy, he's going to murder your season. And Cassidy, I think, has already waited too long because I could tell. I'm barely watching these games because I'm working. But I can tell how gingerly this man is moving. Something's wrong with him. He's having a hard time even when he goes down to stop the game to have a faceoff, to scoop up the puck. Like, he looks kind of old, mannish. And so I think if you wait any longer, you're just going to be playing golf in a couple days.
All right, well, let's talk about some radio. Let's move on to that. And a couple of terrific radio shows, one which gets the attention of radio historians, and it's the classic show Lights Out, and an episode from 1938, Murder Castle, which I listened to, and I have to say, a big meh. It was okay, but it was pretty standard issue.
It was. It is. But it wasn't, right? See what I'm saying? Back in the this is the early days
right.
of radio entertainment. In fact, Lights Out was one of the first sort of popular programs that everybody, so you, like, obviously didn't have a TV, so you're getting into all of this radio stuff, and the premise was that this can be on later at night, and it's like the version of an R movie back in the late 1930s. Stay up, and this is what's going to be on HBO, except it's the radio, and it's horror, and it's grisly, and all of that. So it is well, it's a very well-regarded program in and of itself among radio historians and collectors and all of that, and all of this is in the public domain now, so people can go out and hear it for themselves, too. But it's creaky. It's creaky horror. Like, sometimes you see those old Universal horror films from the 1930s as well, and they're very stage-bound. Sometimes that can be a strength, like the 1931 version of Dracula. It operates in this weird liminal space between sound and silence, and I think that allows us to, forces us to use our imagination more, and certainly you get that with radio. But yes, it's creaky, and it's like this old guy, and he lives in, it's not necessarily a castle, but it's like so sort of generic, the title. And what he does is he recruits single women who have no real family or dependents or anything like that to come work for him. And he has this whole financial setup where they sign over like some money, and then he does the murdering. But before he does the murdering, he does a whole lot of exposition, Mr. Kimball. He decides, like, and then I have you give me your bank numbers, and I murder all the, like, he walks you through it. The entire, like, plot is spoken by this particular bad guy.
Yeah, man, maybe that's part of it, too, is that some of those tropes have been used so many times through the years that listening to it now, it almost sounds like a parody of old-time radio.
It's almost like partaking of a sonic antique. Like, if you watch the 1935 version of Scrooge, which is, of course, based on the Christmas Carol, it has this rudimentary folk art horror charm to it. Like, not professionally done, but maybe the woman down the road took her hand and tried to do, like, there's this woman in my neighborhood when I was growing up, and she was like this artist. She wasn't really an artist. She just had like this potter's wheel and like would do ceramics and like you had a mug. But like when I was a kid, I was thinking like this was Lady Picasso. So you sort of have that deal going on with this throwback. But it's a history lesson. It's not like you're going to be sitting there and revisiting this, I would say, where some of the other radio programs we've spoken about, you can listen to as often as like you might spin Sgt. Pepper, for instance, right? Like if you listen to Sgt. Pepper once, you listen to it 238 times or whatever it's going to be before you croak. And so the best radio is that way. This is not really that way. Yet at the same time, remember when we talked about that episode at Christmas, which was like very amateur hour, but it still managed the one about the sea captain and the ghost and everything,
right,
but it's still mixed from the same time period. It still managed to be chilling in, like, again, that sort of like earthen, rudimentary, almost like accidental way, where this one is a bit canned. So I agree with you there.
But 17 years later, and we go back to the well again, because for me, and I know for you, it continues to just dazzle me and blow me away when I listen to it.
Yeah.
Another great five-part series of yours truly, Johnny Dollar, this time The Plantagenet Matter. And I think am I right on this? You posted a few weeks back your listing of the greatest episodes of all time of Johnny Dollar, and I think you had Plantagenet Matter at number one.
I had it number five.
Oh, number five, okay.
I had our old friend, the Shady Lane.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
That in Vermont is number one. And I think we've touched on all the other ones too, but this one is, and it wasn't like some easy selection process. You have like 50 odd five part episodes to pick from. And this one, again, listeners, if you want to have a contrast and like, what did I compare it to? I think I said like, this is like Picasso's blue period compared to with the other radio program we're just talking about, like a cave painting. Like, this is so technically accomplished, this five-part episode, and so gripping and gutting and dramatic, and everything comes together in this one sort of narrative that just, again, it's like it's music. It's all of these different things at once. But Johnny Dollar, so he's, it's a bit different this time that he's like wrapped up his assignment. And he has like a flight the next day. So he has to stay overnight doing his thing in this town. So he does like what a guy does. And he goes to the bar and he goes out to eat. And he ends up in the parking lot seeing this woman who is getting accosted and physically handled by this man. And he intercedes. And the guy who's doing the manhandling is like, hey, tough guy, like white knighting over here. Like, it's very sort of like modern in a way. And Dollar's just trying to like prevent this act of evil from unfolding any further.
And oh, the characters are so great. I think my favorite character in the episode is Lieutenant Akins.
There are some great sort of like people that Doyle pairs up with. So he's in these different towns and the Dollar pairs up with. And so like, for instance, in Shady Lane, you remember like the great like New England constable guys, like, not his nature, like that guy. So you get these great character actors who are going to be like Bernardo to his Zorro for that particular episode. And they feel like he's one of those people who builds connection and rapport and, dare I say, even friendship very quickly. And that's something that's hard to do in art. We've talked about it sometimes with like some of these like longer on the inside stories, like how to get something going that's so total and so immersive, like quickly. That happens in these Johnny Dollar episodes. But like, so what happens is he takes the woman into the bar to like calm her down. And he is very forthright with us in his narration that he felt like awkward. He's trying to tell jokes and he's not feeling like a cool guy. And it's just like the type of candor you don't get from people unless they're very secure in themselves. It makes us like him even more. And he puts her in a cab afterwards and she just wants to go home. And as he's putting her in the cab, she has some kind of attack. And you just don't see that coming. And he says to the cabbie, go to the hospital. They drive to the hospital and things go from there. But it's completely believable and completely unpredictable.
And I like that he, on more than one occasion, kind of crosses a line professionally, ends up later on turning himself into the police, essentially, and then even gets a little physical at the end.
And how about that sequence, too, when he goes back to the hospital to check on her? I mean, did that not hit home with you?
Yeah,
you've ever had like a relative, like, just the way the hallway looks, it looks differently when you are going to get this sort of news. But he does cross, it's interesting because he crosses some sort of professional lines, but he doesn't cross any ethical lines. He makes mistakes sometimes, but he never makes an immoral choice, I would say,
right,
in any of these episodes. He is someone who, it's like Horatio Hornblower, he is guided by a concept of, like, the world could do well. It would pay out richly for more of us to listen to these episodes, because this is someone who could be an influence to the good. And then in the end, when there is a fight, people who are really into radio are really into it, makes sense, right? They're into sound effects. And so I have never heard, in all of my years of studying radio history, I have never heard a fight. I've never heard sound effects in a fight like this. It must have been like, okay, boys, women, let's just do like some massive orgy of like complete, and you want these sound effects, you want,
oh yeah, and it's not just
like maximum volume,
right? I mean, there's broken glass, there's, you know, I don't know if they brought in a side of beef for the Foley artist to pound, but I mean, it's, yeah, it's a very believable fight.
You know that sequence in the British version of The Office when David Brent, in the Christmas special, he finally tells off Neil, his ex-boss, and Chris Finch. Chris Finch says something horrible to him, and Brent says to him, after being like just kind of this doormat the entire time, although his own deserved doormat sometimes, he says, Chris, why don't you bleep off? And it's like this moment when you're like, yeah, MFR! Like, you just want to jump through the ceiling. When Dollar gets his hands on this guy, it's like they knew that there couldn't be like too many sound effects. They go, it's just this orgy, this cacophony, Wagnerian cacophony of pummeling somebody who absolutely deserves it.
And we've said it time and again, but these Johnny Dollars, and especially, I think, the 15-minute episodes, the five-parters, the writing, the acting, the production, it's as good as anything you'll see today on television, on streaming services. It's just brilliant.
Yeah, it's better. It's the best. It's some of the, like I've said, and you have to be careful with this, because when you say to someone, it's some of the best art I've ever experienced, people will be like, oh, I didn't really understand King Lear in high school. It's some of the best entertainment I've ever experienced, too. And this is not someone who's like 84 saying this to you about like when it was my time back in the day, and I just watched Duke Snider, the Duke of Flatbush, and now I watch some Johnny Dollar. It's not that. This is someone who only came to this program like in the last, well, I always was aware of it, but I only got deeply immersed in it in the last like couple of years, really. And it's, I mean, take the Colin Fleming challenge. Go out there and listen to, go to the blog, look at the top five episodes, which I have the links to. Listen to any of them. And if you don't like them, well, you're just a kind of moronic plebeian. No, right. That's wrong. I'll give you your money back.
There
that's
you go.
That's what I'll do.
Even better right there. You can't beat that promise. We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. Let's move from radio to film and a 1951 film noir with an interesting cast that makes it all work somehow. Robert Mitchum, Jane Russell, and Vincent Price in I think, one of the best performances that he ever gave.
One of the best. And well, he was always good. He was consistent, but it was also one of the performances I'm thinking that kind of got him his reputation as Hammy. And it's not a very deserved reputation. Like this is a weird film, isn't it? Like it's a very strange, I call it a jumble film, where it's like, have the apples, have the oranges, have the horseshoes, have that, like everything is just shoveled into this film. It's like, make it work. Like it's sort of this tense thriller at certain points. And then at the end, it becomes this satirical romp in the, well, again, in the Zorro style of like the Disney version of the Zorro narrative, with Vincent Price talking in this high tone theatrical dialogue. Now, I think that's where a lot of his reputation stems from and then was built upon as this hammy actor, because he's playing a hammy actor. Well, he's sort of playing like a tepid, unsure of himself actor for a while, whose personal life does not sort of cuckolded. It doesn't really live up to his swashbuckling on-screen reputation. But then he gets his moment to go for it and be the hero and just like this swashbuckling type of picture. And he uses that rich, flowery language of like pirate films from the 30s and 40s. But it's not like he wrote these lines. He was delivering the lines as they were. And you really notice, too, Vincent Price was a big guy.
Yeah.
Because Robert Mitchum's a big guy. And when they're standing next to each other, like Vincent Price has like 4 inches on him. And Mitchum is like his whole thing in a lot of this film is like, I'm Mitchum. I took my shirt off. I'm brawny. Want to kiss? Like, that's a lot of what he does. It's like, in fact, I'm watching again last night. Every time he's like hooking up with Jane Russell, I couldn't stop myself from saying, Mitchum. He's just like, he's just going to town again and again. And any chance to get his shirt off is what they do. But Vince Price is like a hulking guy. So it's this weird sort of combo of noir and horror and thriller and mystery, and the plot makes like no sense whatsoever. You don't really understand what the bad guys are trying to finagle, but it all has this ropey charm to it.
And a great performance early in his career from Raymond Burr.
He could be unrecognizable to some people, don't you think, in this film?
Oh, yeah.
Like he is. So sort of like the premise, kind of, as best as I can figure it out in all the years I've watched this, is that he looks a little like Mitchum, and they're going to do some plastic surgery sort of thing. So he's fairly svelte. He's like, you can watch the beginning of this film and not even know that it's him. And it's like, it's a long way off between this and like just a few years later in Rear Window. And also,
You
know who's in this too, who's fairly unrecognizable just a few years after Treasure of the Sierra Madre, is Tim Holt.
Oh, that's
like
right.
This cop that gets this fed who gets rubbed out you could watch this film and be like, whoa, who ate all the pies?
Jim Backus makes an appearance. And I didn't realize, too, that apparently Howard Hughes came in. And maybe one of the reasons why it's a little bit difficult to follow the plot is that Hughes came in and had it recut.
That happens a number of times. This isn't even like the ropiest, sort of most jumbly one of the Mitchum RKO noirs. And I'm not talking about like Out of the Past, but like when Howard Hughes is involved, there is some serious Cuisinart slice and dice, Pacho movie making going on at some point. But it's like one of those films where you're, I don't know, that sort of like happened, like To Have and Have Not. It's another film like that. None of these people are in it. But it's like, nah, so it goes, whatever. Like you're invested mostly in the hangout. And this is a great place to hang out. It's coastal. It's this nice resort. And you want to kind of go on vacation there and like fish and hunt with these people and like lay out in the sun and ogle the ladies. So it's just like a great sort of film noir hangout film. And a lot of film noir, let's face it, is very nihilistic. And it is depressing, and this is not. Mitchum doesn't die. Everything works out. It's cool. Watch it again.
Check it out, His Kind of Woman. And finally, we bring it back around. We started with sports, and we end with sports, talking about second baseman. And then you pointed out in your message to me, I think you're right, that it's a position that really gets short shrift when it comes particularly to the Hall of Fame.
I think it's partially because it's like where you stick that guy in Little League. Like, he can't throw it across the diamond, that short throw. And I was thinking about, like, players who are underrated and overrated, all of this. I think about that a lot. And so I saw the other day, for instance, this isn't really on the subject, but I saw this argument about, like, who was better, Ichiro or Ricky Henderson. And it just blows my mind how little people know about, and not just sports, but understanding the numbers of sports, the metrics, all of that. Because Ricky Henderson was like twice the player that this singles hitter was. This is a very limited singles hitter. And I'll hear people talk about Ryan Sandberg to give, what can you call it, a modern example, like a fairly modern example. He's one of those guys, like Kirby Puckett, different position, obviously, center fielder, that is like one of the 50 or 60 best baseball players of all time, and no one discusses him that way. Like, you probably went to Baseball Reference and looked at his stats, and I bet you were surprised.
You know, I don't know, because I was a Sandberg fan. I liked him when he played. He was steady, and he was a run producer, which you don't usually see that from a second baseman. And he was one of those guys who was just always going to drive in a ton of runs wherever you hit him in the lineup, and had a great knack for getting on base.
He scored a lot of runs, but he led the league in home runs once. He had 40 home runs one year. He was a second baseman. I think that's just like, he was like a 30 home run guy. He was like Dustin Pedroia hitting 40 home runs. He was a better fielder than Pedroia. He was a better hitter. He was a better base runner, and he hit 40 home runs. He led the league in total bases one year, I think. This is second base, and this is not even the year when he wins the MVP, 1984, which is actually very statistically similar to Dustin Pedroia's 2008 MVP year, to talk about second baseman. But this guy was one of the best fielders in the history of the sport at any position, and he led the league in runs like three or four times. It's astounding to me, and he sort of morphed. He went from being like this 15 home run, 70 RBI, 301 batting average, 30 to 40 steals type of gold glove defender, to 30 home runs, 90 RBI, power hitter, still winning gold gloves. But for a second baseman to lead the league in total bases in the modern era, that's just, who does that? It doesn't happen, really.
He was also a rock at that position. 11 of his 16 years, he played at least 153 games.
And I remember he took a year. There was a year where he didn't play, and he came back, and he still was like this 25-92 RBI type of guy. But it was a lot of power. I mean, it sounds maybe to someone like, oh, well, everyone hits home runs now. But you have to understand how rare, like when Bobby Doerr hit 27 home runs or whatever he was hitting, like in the late 40s, like that was like Harmon Killebrew at second base. It was surprising, shocking. This was not that position. This was like the offense of the catcher. You're not, except the catcher was a big guy. Second baseman are small men. So you expect maybe the catcher every now and then we'll run into one. But, and of course, Sandberg's swing was perfectly made for line drive hitter. It's a good place to play Wrigley Field. Whereas like a line drive hitter, say at Fenway Park, it's not so great because you're smashing a lot of would-be home runs elsewhere into doubles off of the wall. So it was the sort of perfect marriage of ball player and ballpark. But one of those guys where it's like he was just, and he was every bit as good as a fielder, but he's never talked about as sort of one of these all-timers. It's the same with Puckett. Like, I'll hear people say, he shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. Like, look what the guy did every single year for like 12 or 13 years. These are just like some of the best players there have ever been.
And speaking of guys that don't come up in the conversation about greats of all time, Rogers Hornsby.
I think he comes up, but he doesn't come up as what he is. He's the best right-handed batter ever to play the sport of baseball. Now, this is a guy who hit 400 a measly three times. He popped for 424 one year. It's pretty good. And it's not like this was 1861 and the Civil War was still going on. I get all of that. This was the 1920s. And so he's winning two Triple Crowns. And I think each time he wins the Triple Crown, he hits over 400. He has a year. And I'm pretty sure it's second. I think number one is first with Babe Ruth with 457. But Hornsby had 450 total bases in a single season.
Yeah.
So he's like within, he's within like a home run and a triple of Babe Ruth, who's like, and that's Babe Ruth's greatest year. I think Lou Gehrig, I think he had over 400 total bases over five different seasons.
Yeah, that 19,
usually
that 22 season, he led the league in runs with 141. He led the league in hits with 250, which for years was the second highest single season total of all time. Led the league in doubles with 46, homers with 42, drove in 152, batted 401, 459 on base percentage, and led the league in slugging, total bases, and had an OPS of 1.181. My Lord.
And his OPS plus was probably well over 200.
207, so, for God's sakes.
Yeah, that's just like, that's like the kind of OPS you have when you just have like the greatest week of your career.
Right, which by the way was only the third best OPS plus of his career.
Yeah, he was good at the OPS plus. He's like, what is he? He's like seventh or eighth all time. It's like Ruth is first, and I think Ted Williams is second. And he was kind of like washed up as this stud by like 32, 33. If you look at like his Diamond Stars card from the 1930s, it's another guy who's enjoyed a pork chop or two. Like he's exactly like Charles Atlas. And then later in life, he becomes this curmudgeon dick. Do you remember this?
Oh, yes.
Roger Maris?
Yeah.
Roger Maris hated him because he trashed Roger Maris in 1961. It's the end of Hornsby's life. He's like, I'm dying soon. I'll just trash Maris. That this guy, this like 260 hitter, is going to break this record. When Maris like saw him in 1962, he like turned his back on him. Like Hornsby was just like this bitter, unpleasant, all around bad guy from everything you've read. But he is a right-handed batter. I don't know who you could put above him, really. I mean, there are other guys who did it. It depends if you're talking like career value and length. When we talked about Hank Aaron, certainly, I think he gets underrated and overshadowed by Willie Mays, who he was better than. But Hornsby, for just like, are you kidding me? You can't do that in Little League type of stats from like a highly competitive era of baseball. It was still like modern. Obviously, 424 is misleading. But the things that he was doing, the Triple Crown, still the Triple Crown. You still have to lead in those categories. You do it twice. I don't know. That's just a winner right there.
Check it out. Look at some of the numbers. You will be amazed and dazzled by Rogers Hornsby. And if you go to his website, you'll be amazed and dazzled by Colin Fleming at colinfleminglit.com. Subscribe to the blog, Many Moments More. Get your hands on Meatheads. Say the realest things as well. Colin, we thank you as always. Hope it cools off. But either way, in any conditions, you will remain a Zulu warrior.
Ha! You too, buddy.
All right. Thanks, Colin. See you next week.